episode of the Rectic Pulse. Daphne Jackson here, and I am so excited to kick 2022, which is our third year of this podcast. Crazy to think that we started back in 2020 when the pandemic had kind of hit, and now we are kicking off our third year of bringing you this podcast, and I'm super thrilled, super honored, and on behalf of our Rectic Pulse team, thank you for tuning in every week and listening to us. So now let's get right into it. But before I introduce our guest for today, I did want to make a quick disclaimer that what you hear today are our speakers' opinions and expressions of their own and do not represent their employer. So without further ado, with me today for today's episode, we have a couple of special guests. We have Louis Vargas, who is the Principal Sanctions Compliance Officer in the Sanctions Control and Technology Department at Danske Bank, and then Christian Stott, who is the Managing Compliance Officer for Financial Crime Advisory for Danske as well. Welcome, guys, and thank you for joining me today in today's episode.
Thanks for having us, Daphne.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. Much appreciated.
Awesome. So before we get started, I'll give you guys the ball, and if you guys could tell us a little bit about you and your experience in the industry, that will be fantastic, and we'll get right going.
Sure. So as you mentioned, my name is Louis Vargas. I work for Danske Bank now in the sanctions and embargo team. I joined a little over a year ago. I moved over from New York City, and I've been doing sanctions compliance for almost 8 years, you could say now, and a little bit of other things, but mostly focusing on sanctions. And in my particular role at the moment, I focus on controls and technology. Just making sure that the tech that we have in place is operating optimally the way we intended to, capturing the appropriate hits that we want, and also making sure that the screening units are, you know, reviewing transactions or customer information in an efficient and appropriate way. So again, thank you for inviting me. And I just want to quickly state that, you know, the opinions that you'll hear today from me are strictly my own and in no way represent Danske Bank, even though I work for the bank, but these are solely my personal opinions. Thank you.
Thank you, Louis. Christian?
Yeah, and thanks again for having us, Daphne. My name is Christian. I've been with Danske Bank for about a year, managing a small Nordic team, performing financial crime compliance advisory for our large corporates and institutions division. Prior to joining Danske Bank, I lived in the UK for the past 12 years. Obviously, a bit of a culture shock coming back to my native Denmark, but generally just happy and excited to be here.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, as you guys know, Danske is in the Nordic region. So let's get right started. Let's talk a little bit about the regulatory landscape down there in the Nordics. In terms of technical compliance, and you both are very well versed in that world, we all know Sweden and Norway have the most comprehensive implementation of the FATF recommendations. So can you kind of talk us a little bit about the current landscape that you guys are currently experiencing in the region, and how does it possibly benchmark against the rest of Europe? And even perhaps if you can talk about that, of course, with the world.
Yeah, I think, I was actually a bit surprised to see that, Sweden and Norway scored above average in the Nordics on implementation of the 40 FATF recommendations. I mean, I certainly hope there's only 40 plus the 11 terrorist financing ones, but I think it's an interesting discussion to look at, 40 recommendations versus our primary regulatory backdrop, which obviously comes from the European Union, particularly given that Norway is not a European Union member and therefore is still a couple of steps behind on regulatory alignment with 5 MLD and eventually 6 MLD. So it's a bit surprised at the comparison. I don't know, Louis, if that's something that feeds into your world at all.
Not so much. I mean, sanctions screening and the kind of requirements around it are pretty standard across. So it's not something specifically tied into this these recommendations, which I guess is kind of fortunate because, you know, there's so much movement around for different reasons. And, you know, we kind of always have to shift gears or always kind of be ahead of what the regulators want. Yeah. But and to my understanding, as far as these recommendations, I think we're pretty aligned or maybe even ahead of the game.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I mean, it's one of the perennial challenges for any pan-European bank is ensuring, well, how do we make sure that, you know, general rules and principles internally align with all the different market areas that we operate in? People like to think of us Scandies as one homogenous clump. We often do group together whenever we're abroad. We move in packs, but our regulatory frameworks are slightly different, and that has to do with the nature of European regulation and that ultimately, if you look at the different directives, be they financial crime, regulatory compliance related, as long as they're directives, they have to be transposed into national law based on a local interpretation, which obviously can lead to some divergence, even though that the sort of, you know, regulatory source is the same. And if you then throw in a non-EU but still very similar regulatory regime into the mix, you can actually get a very, very complicated compliance landscape, which obviously makes it difficult for organizations that operate in these different market areas to ensure that they're capturing everything in the different jurisdictions.
Yeah, and just to piggyback on that, I mean, you know, from the sanctions perspective, you know, similarly, the EU releases directives and recommendations, but each member state has to ratify that. So, you know, we see similar kind of complexities when you're talking about, you know, how different countries want to align with certain regulations. So that, you know, that adds a kind of wrinkle and also adds some time issues when we have to continually go to the competent regulatory body to get advice on what we should do on certain things. So, you know, as Christian rightfully mentioned, you know, those are things they deal with within the AML landscape, but also very similar to sanctions.
Sounds like a very complex dynamic, right? Especially when you have to bring in people from outside of the EU. So let's move on a little bit and then talk about how do you guys kind of manage all of that, right? Assuming information sharing, it's also a big part of that puzzle. So how can banks and other financial institutions expect more of this moving forward? Like, do you see that being a big part of that framework? How do you foresee that being played out in the future?
I mean, that's a good question. But, you know, ideally, the way I like to work is I like to benchmark with other financial institutions and have kind of an open dialogue. Obviously, you know, there's certain information you can't openly share, but I feel like there's a lot of institutions that, you know, highly guard what they're doing. So, you know, while it makes perfect sense that, you know, there's some transparency between financial institutions, you know, that's not something that's that we could take for granted or a standard. Hopefully, you know, you know, our program matures and we build relationships with other financial institutions, hopefully that's something that we could build upon, but definitely not something that is automatic or that we could take for granted. You know, at least, you know, from what I've seen so far. What have you seen in that space, Christian?
I think it's always a tricky environment to navigate. You know, there are plenty of rules around sharing of information between any institution, let alone the financial services. And I think the real challenge for a bank when it comes to sharing information and trends is really how do we view technical compliance with information sharing more broadly? Is this sort of, you know, a spirit or letter of the law interpretation that we're going for? But in general, you know, I think in terms of how we manage regulatory divergence, though, which I think sort of is also an area that you were interested in, Daphne, is really through strong coffee and dedicated employees. You know, as an organization that operates in multiple jurisdictions, regardless of where they're based, I mean, any organization has the responsibility to ensure that it's aligned with local principles and regulations. So it's not a question of how do we manage it? It's manage it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe some institutions or other companies are just maybe worried about maybe sharing too much. But yeah, I think the more we try to reach out and touch someone, as the old AT&T commercial says, I think maybe it'll bring some comfort to the industry that we can help each other and not just kind of do things in our own way by ourselves.
Totally. Do you think that data also plays a part in that, in the way that, you know, it's being shared, the quality of that data? I know those requirements are constantly increasing from both the sanctions and AML perspective, but what is your take on data quality as well?
I mean,
does that play a role as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's both the compliance perspective and then the good business practice perspective, which is the more information, say, for example, a bank collects on its customers, the bigger the operational burden. So despite a very sort of, you know, explicit requirement to understand your customer, their expected behavior, that sort of thing, there's always a danger of TMI, even though, you know, you're desperately trying to get a full picture of your customer. So really it's about understanding, well, what is relevant for a financial services provider to know about their customer. And when we are communicating either, and by me, I mean, obviously the proverbial we, when communicating with external or internal stakeholders, to ensure that the only information that's transmitted is actually relevant to the discussion at hand. Obviously, I mean, I think, Louis, in your world, that's a lot more complicated because, you know, you prevent entry from unwanted individuals who aren't customers, for example.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely more tricky in my space. But, you know, I think, you know, we'll be fooling ourselves if we didn't say that data integrity is not a problem in all institutions, right? I mean, big or small, there's issues with data, with getting appropriate data, clean data, sourcing it from the right place. There's, you know, big institutions and small, you know, there's different systems that are being used. So I know there's a big push to kind of consolidate that now that, you know, technology is getting better. So, you know, we need a data lake that kind of pulls together all data from across the different businesses so that we could build on the right, build up the right reporting or screening of this data. So, you know, I think that, you know, all institutions face this issue. I think there are some that are probably getting better at it quicker than others. But yeah, I think, you know, to have this open communication between other banks, we don't have to be that granular to touch on our previous kind of topic. But, you know, I think it's maybe sharing how we address these issues and things we're working on to get better data or, you know, clean it up in a way that it makes screening more effective. Those are the types of conversations we got to get to.
Totally. And now with like data protection too, I kind of probably see that as another challenge, right? So how do like regulations like GDPR like affect your day-to-day, especially when it comes to data, right? In the fight against financial crime from both sanctions and AML perspective. So what are some of those challenges for you?
So I think we have to be very, very wary of going into any sort of specifics on our end. I mean, in general, I don't necessarily see an inherent conflict between sound data practices and sort of the efforts that, you know, financial institutions, NBFIs, PSPs have made to prevent, you know, financial crime. I think it's more a question of some general principles on how we as organizations within an industry that is subject to heavy regulation actually adapt to these challenges. And as I mentioned before, you know, ensuring that you capture the right information on your customers, right, and that, you know, that it in any instance is defensible that you maintain this information is absolutely critical. But then feeds into a wider discussion of, well, when looking at something like GDPR, for example, are we more interested in the spirit or the letter of the regulation? From my perspective, there's two aspects to GDPR, and please remember, I'm not a data protection lawyer, but you know, part of this is ensuring that any organization that collects and processes personal information does so responsibly. And then there's the other side of it, which is, you know, people were sick of getting spammed by companies that maintain and process information with no relevant business need. Mm-hmm. And that being said, there's no, I don't see an inherent conflict between those two general principles and the information banks collect to prevent financial crime, particularly given that we're talking about personal and sensitive information, but one that has very little commercial value. So that's generally advice that could be given if you're, you know, faced with a customer that doesn't want to give you their date of birth, for example, because why on earth do you need it? Where you'd say, well, it's simply not for any commercial value. It's to make sure that we can positively identify you against a government database or a trade register or anything of the like. And again, I mean, you know, Louis, in your world where, you know, you deal with information that has to do with non-customers, for example, or hopefully non-customers, should say, it gets a little bit trickier, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, because, you know, especially when you're dealing with common names, right? So you can get multiple potential matches on that. So how do you differentiate it, right? So you're going to ask for additional demographic information from the customer or the non-customer so that you could make that determination whether it's truly a match or not. In the US, we do get some pushback here or there, but usually we can obtain the information that we need to make that assessment. For being here in the EU for, as I mentioned before, a little over a year, I've seen a difference with that. And I feel like sometimes, and sorry if this sounds too blunt, but, you know, so many institutions are afraid of breaching GDPR that they just use that as kind of a safeguard to say, well, I don't feel comfortable asking my customer for this information because they might get mad at me for bothering them. So I'm just going to say it's a GDPR issue. But I think I agree with kind of what Christian was saying is like, you know, we have to educate not only our relationship managers, but our customers to say, you know, we're not asking this because we want to bother you, but we need to know, you know, the appropriate information so that we can make sure that we're safeguarding the financial system from these potential criminals, right? So I think it's just changing the dynamic and changing the perception of why we're asking these questions, right? We're not doing it to harass anybody. We're not doing it to use their data in inappropriate ways. We're using this data so that we could make sure that, you know, our customers or non-customers are, you know, safe to do business with.
Yeah, and I think one final comment on this is, you know, something like data protection rules should never be used as a crutch to not ask the right questions. You know, obviously we have a parochial interest in financial crime prevention as, you know, as dedicated professionals. Which effectively means that as professionals, I think it's important to be able to make the judgment call on, you know, what is absolutely necessary to understand a customer relationship. And any organization has to have that internal reckoning on whether the right considerations are being made to what level of detail an organization understands its customers.
Yeah, and just one last point on that is, you know, we I think in general financial institutions take it for granted that, you know, we are able to screen against all the sanctions list that we feel is necessary based on our risk tolerance, based on the jurisdictions we operate in, contractual agreements. You know, you think of it. If we have a nexus to that region, it might make sense that we screen against that sanctions list. But when you think about GDPR and how different member states are viewing it, you know, I won't go into specifics, but there's a specific country, you know, within the Nordic region that has a different opinion and says, we don't, you know, why would we want for example, a list that's not part of our jurisdiction, like the OFAC list, why would we want or allow our customers to be screened against it? You know, and because it's our bank policy, I think it's pretty much accepted that all banks use the OFAC list to screen against transactions and customers because of the, you know, kind of secondary sanctions risk and the overreaching, you know, a lot of people would argue overreaching scope of OFAC in the United States, that, you know, it makes sense that they would screen against it to make sure they comply and don't put their bank or their customers at risk from breaching OFAC sanctions. But this particular country has a different view. They're like, that jurisdiction has, you know, the U.S. has no jurisdiction over us. Why would I allow our customers to be screened against that list? So you have that debate as well. So while it might seem logical that we do certain things, you know, like I said, it's just like a lot of things we do, it's open to interpretation. And this particular country has an issue with that. So I think that's something that we have to consider and something that we have to keep in mind, that, you know, this landscape is ever changing and opinions are ever changing. And when you're dealing with the EU and the different opinions of the member states, it could get even trickier.
Right, just adding that level of complexity in there, right? Because then you have to take in consideration not just one body, but every country has its own.
Exactly.
Very good. Well, thank you guys so much. And, you know, but before we wrap up the conversation, because we're at time, I would love to hear your thoughts about what you think, especially as we're coming out to the end of 2021, and how do you foresee... What do you foresee happening in 2022 with the current regulatory landscape? Do you guys see any trends that you may see more, or you may see more of in 2022 in the Nordics, in Denmark, or maybe on a global scale? Would love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, of course. And I think we should also stress that there are lots of aspects of, you know, differing technical implementation of regulation that are relevant aside from data protection. But one of the things that I think personally I'm very, very excited about is the European commitment to a common anti-money laundering and terrorist financing framework, which has been agreed by the European Commission, I believe will be implemented in the next 2 or 3 years. Hopefully what this means is that any financial institution operating within the European Union will be set under, you know, the same set of rules, the same set of requirements, and you'll see less regulatory divergence within the Union. Of course, if you have a financial services institution that operates outside the European Union, this may be of limited value, but certainly lifts some of the burden. So that enhanced harmonization of regulation at the European level, I think, is something that's going to be of huge benefit to any obliged entity in the European Union.
And to kind of touch on what I see would be kind of hot topics in 2022 is, you know, if we look at ransomware incidents and the approach of how to handle ransomware, I think ransomware attacks, I should say, as you know, there's still not a lot out there on it. So I think you're going to see more commentary and more advisories on it. I know OFAC from the US has supplied quite a bit of info on that. There's also a reporting requirement. And you might think, well, what does sanctions have to do with ransomware? Well, a lot of these actors that have already been identified that's part of this activity have been sanctioned by the US. And when they do these investigations to new attacks, they are continually adding these bad actors to the sanctions list. So when a company might pay for a ransomware attack, they could be also in breach of U.S. sanctions. So I think that's something to keep in mind. And I think you will see the U.K. and the EU, follow suit of OFAC to release some kind of guidance or advisory on that. And the last bit, I've been saying this maybe for the last 5 years, is maritime risk. I think that's something that we're going to continue to see movement on. You know, OFAC obviously has been big players in this, but I think you're going to see obviously more from the UK now that because of Brexit, they're going to be more in the forefront with issuing advisories and opinions on things. And I hope the EU follows. But maritime risk, believe it or not, is not just a sanctions issue. It touches across all the financial crime pillars. So I think, you know, I'm hoping, and I think that 2022, you're going to see more movement on that and more focus on it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Looking forward to see where that plays out for sure. So anyhow, thank you both so much for joining us and sharing your knowledge and your expertise with not only with me, but with our listeners. Thank you again. I'm so grateful for this conversation. I've learned so much.
It's a pleasure, Daphne.
Yeah, pleasure, Daphne. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. And thank you to our listeners again for tuning in today and every day into each episode that we produce. Without you guys, we wouldn't be here. So I'm really excited to kick off 2022 on such a great note. So stay tuned for more episodes in the near future. We have a great lineup for you in the next few weeks. So stay tuned to hear more from Ian Mitchell at The Noble and also from our friends at The Century. So thank you once again. Stay safe. See you next time. Thanks.